Welcome to the Chasing Tomorrow podcast. I have one of my longtime friends, colleagues, and guys I admire who is going to spend a little bit of time talking about the topics that we all love hearing about, purpose and meaning and mission. Brett Magpyong is a recent author of a book called The Delta Theorem, An Innovative Framework for Being Fully Alive and Truly Wealthy, which I want you to define that for us. Comes alive with purpose on purpose. We like that. Brett's been out pushing the book and getting people to hear his story, and we're going to get to do that right now. Brett, welcome to the podcast.
Joe, thank you so much for having me on. It's really an honor to be here.
There's nothing like the origin story, Brett, and I'm sure that in the beginning, there wasn't a book in your life, nor the journey of the adventures you've taken on or the big things you did in your business life. So just give us a little bit of background. Where'd you grow up? What were your interests? What were you doing early in your life? We'll see how that evolves.
Yeah, there definitely was not a book in the beginning, but ultimately that's where things landed over the last year or so. But I grew up here in Southern California. I still live in Southern California. I was the son, or am the son, of a civil engineer for the city of Los Angeles. And my mom was a homemaker. She has passed away. My father's still alive. He's 86 years old. And he's still riding his 10-speed bicycle long distances almost on a daily basis, which is pretty amazing, which kind of leads into a little bit of my upbringing. I grew up an older brother and myself, and we were definitely a athletic and jock-minded family, if you will.
Yeah,
I like to tell the story, Joe, that one of the first tests I ever failed as a kid was I was asked to name the four seasons. And of course, I said football, basketball, baseball, and hockey, because in my household, those were the only seasons. And when I got back the test and it said, F, what's winter, spring, summer, and fall? I had no idea, frankly, in my house.
So
that was kind of the upbringing. Lots of athletics, lots of team sports and what have you. And it carried on through a lot of my life and my career and what have you. So yeah, that's my upbringing.
I like that. And so you got through school, show up in the workforce. What was your early work? What were you interested in? What were you doing?
Well, I started my career at a very large professional services firm. Price Waterhouse is what it was called at the time. It's now PwC. And I started off just as a, you know, an associate or a staff person, I think is what they called it at the time, which meant that at that time, you were to be seen and not heard, if you will. I did a lot of copying of things and made sure that engagements were going and that I showed up, and long hours and all the things of what you're starting off to do. Ultimately, it was just such a great springboard to the rest of my career, because starting at a very prominent firm like that just opened up so many avenues to me. It turns out that the avenue that it did open up for me here in Southern California was to get involved in providing very specialized personal financial services to senior executives of some of the corporations that Pricewaterhouse was engaged with. But also I worked with entertainers, I worked with athletes, I worked with a number of people in Hollywood to kind of provide them with this customized personal financial services, which I did for 35 years of my career. So yeah, it was a great, great place to start and a very rewarding career for me.
Yeah, we like that sort of, we have to start somewhere, right? And how we apply ourselves really is the beginning of what our lives and our career becomes. It's the same kind of thing, like there was always a book in you, but you didn't know that because you had to start somewhere. And it's the same in your career. You didn't know specifically you'd do that, but you get in the game. Good piece of advice, huh? So as you started to get into this, you're working with people, you're helping them with their finances, you're probably learning a lot about that. Were you doing any athletics or big challenges along the way, working, building a family? What was going on also?
Well, I'd say that early on in my career, it was just mostly work, and I was not engaged that much with any kind of significant physical challenges, if you will. Ultimately, I did get married, which was a large relational challenge, if you will. And I've been married for over 30 years now to my same wife. And in the course of that, we have a daughter and she's 25 years old. And so relational challenges for sure kicked in. What I realized though, was that if I started to have just my career and my relationships, that the physical nature of things was, and something that was so pivotal to me growing up, was something that was still there for me. And so eventually I did engage with doing things like 5Ks is what I would start off mm-hmm. with, and running and doing some exercise from that perspective, which ultimately led to me nowadays doing some kind of crucible events. And I became a coach inside of an organization that was run by a former Navy SEAL. And that coaching program required me to pass a very physical kind of, you know, a crucible event in order to get my coaching certification. So it was a progression over time, but the very roots of me having grown up in athletics was always there and built into the challenges that I always faced across my career.
Now let's talk about that for a little bit, this need over time to build a stronger physical you to carry the rest of you. So the intellectual you is there. You have this relational you that's there. You're becoming a family person. But without that physical dimension, something was missing. It seemed like you filled in a void. How, like, as you did more of that, how did that show up? How did the rest of life sort of play out for you?
Look, I always felt like if you show up to my office, let's say, if I showed up to my office and I didn't have good sleep the night before, or I didn't fuel very well, guess what happened? I just didn't show up very well at all. Mm-hmm. And so I learned very early on that the physical nature of things, not alone of like endurance or strength training or those kinds of physical attributes associated with working out and what have you, but sleeping well and fueling my body and hydrating and that kind of thing, it frankly helped me to show up better in the workplace, which when I showed up better both in the workplace and at home, I showed up as a better version of myself as a result of that. So it was clear to me that when I wasn't doing those things, I could feel as if there's something really wrong here. I just didn't feel good physically, but I also didn't feel good mentally. And that had a significant impact on, let's say, that engagement. And so I ultimately realized, gosh, I really got to stick with this, making sure that my physical body was going well. And it helped me to show up that much better.
It's really fascinating because we would probably, both of us here, sometimes people say like, well, that's going to tire me out, or that's going to put strain and stress on me. I don't really have time for that. And then this sort of deleterious effect that could come from that, right? Where we're not actually leveraging the underlying infrastructure. It's like, don't put oil in the car, never change the tires and expect it to keep going well. And we have to invest in the infrastructure of ourselves. And look, you found it without a direct plan to say, hey, this is really important.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, let me give you the story of something I alluded to previously. I did go through this coaching program, and the coaching program had a lot of training around the table stakes for how to be a coach, asking good questions and engaging and active listening and those kinds of things. But what it also added was this dimension of the physical nature of things. And what it ultimately meant was that I had to pass a 12-hour crucible event, which was fashioned after kind of a Navy SEAL Hell Week type of engagement. They had us doing things that we didn't know what was coming at us. There was a lot of chaos and we had to learn how to be mentally tough, physically strong, those kinds of things. Well, the first thing that I ever did was I was invited with my cohort early on in this program down to San Diego. And when we met, we had to do 300 burpees in 30 minutes. Hey, Joe, I hadn't done a burpee in 20 years. Okay. We were doing 10 burpees every minute on the minute. And I literally was gassed at about 110 of those, 11 minutes into this. And I was gassed. But I had to decide real quick, like, was I going to get voted off the island, if you will, or was I going to like endure this? And when you do things physically, as you and I both know, it's not just the physical that gets touched on. What gets touched on is the mental, the intuitional or instinctual nature of us, our natural kind of tendencies, even spiritual things that come out of us. And so that was the nature of things. Well, I learned in the course of that, that if I was going to pass this, I was going to have to train. We talk about doing things. It's really in the training. It's not in the trying. It's in the training. And I remember waking up at 4 o'clock in the morning because I had to get on the freeway by 7 to get in the office. And I woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning. It was still dark out. And I was in my garage and I was doing burpees. And I had to answer this question. Why am I doing this? Why am I doing this? And what happened as a result of having a very powerful why, which was tapped into because of the physical nature of things, which was, I want to be a coach. That's what I want to be. And I want to get certified through this organization, that I would do those burpees. I would get up at 4 a.m. It didn't mean that I went to bed at 7 the night before. I actually did not, but I did get up. And when the buzzer rang and I thought to myself, am I getting up right now or am I not? I had to tap into that very powerful why. Why am I doing this? And I would not have learned that if I didn't put myself through the training for that crucible event. So for me, that's the value that people gain, or we all gain, from the physical nature of things. I mean, that is just so critical for our, how we show up, as I said.
Yeah. I think that this is the thing about, of course, like you for the past 20 years, which is, it's, are we going to reach in to something that we haven't tapped into? So I think the analogy for me is perfect. For 30 years plus, you help advise people how to invest their money. And they would be focused. They'd call Brett. How am I doing? How's the portfolio? Where should I grow? What should I do? What are a growth fund? And then no one calling you, when you did become a coach, they did say, Brett, what should I be doing? How should I be investing in myself? How should I be growing? What should I be like? We know how to invest our dollars, but more important is our being, our physical capability. We don't invest enough, but you found it through your why. And the why on the money, I guess, is pretty clear. Pay for my bills, pay for college or mortgage or something. But we do need to develop more of this why, that this investment in our physical being is the key decision, because it carries everything else. And so as you've gone through this and you've been coaching now, and so how do you bring that sort of the two together? Because you're an expert in the financial stuff, of course. Now you're an expert in the coach. How do they come together for you?
Well, the convergence of all of it, quite frankly, was that in working with my clients, one of the things that I learned very early on was that there are many aspects to wealth. You alluded to the subtitle of my book, and in there I talk about true wealth. And true wealth is I was very purposeful of using the word true, because what I learned inside of advising these clients, and frankly coaching these clients, was this: table stakes were investment returns. That's what they brought us to do. They brought us in to do. But inevitably, in almost every meeting that I had, because I was working with literally the less than 1%, the people that had Boeing business jets and what have you. I just happened to fall into that space. Here's what the questions they would ask. What's the money going to do to my kids? That's relational wealth. That's not financial wealth. Or how is this going to impact my spouse or my friends or how people see me and that kind of thing? That's relational wealth. But they also ask, how come I don't have peace of mind? I have all this wealth, but I don't feel like I have peace of mind. That's mental or spiritual wealth.
Yep.
Often cases, they would say, I've got all this and I feel horrible. My health is terrible. That's physical wealth. And then they would say something like, I don't feel like time is my own anymore, believe it or not. And that's temporal or time wealth. And so when I talk about true wealth, learned from years of experience of working with the most financially wealthy people in our country, was that true wealth in their eyes was financial, relational, mental and spiritual, physical and temporal. That's when you have true wealth. And so for me, I started to see that, like, that was the kind of thing that really was interesting for people. Me, you, anyone, we know that the financial is important and it's critical, but it's only a small piece of what it means to feel really, really wealthy. And so the physical component of stuff was built into that recognition and realization.
It's great. I mean, it's a beautiful capturing of those different elements that most people don't have a language that they could use. They know the don't feel good, right? I don't feel satisfied, or I don't feel great, even though my bank account is full and I'm filling it up more. So it's great for you as a coach then to dimensionalize it, because then that's something I can work on, right? I can take each of those pieces and what am I doing with my 106 hours in a week? Are any of them working on my relational wealth or my emotional wealth? And so,
that's right. Yeah. So here was one thing that I did with one of my clients. This gentleman was and is a giant. I mean, just literally was a larger than life individual. And he had a young son, was in his teens and stuff. And so I said to him at one point, listen, your son, he, like everyone else, is like, he just looks up to you. And all of us are intimidated by you. And you probably use that intimidation in business, which he acknowledged. But this is your son who you don't want to use that with. Why don't you do this? Why don't you invite your son into the boardroom with you and just tell him to sit behind you and watch you operate there? Okay. That was the kind of advice that was there. Now, of course, we dealt with his wealth management and financial management, that kind of stuff. But that was the value add. And he did bring his son in and develop the relational wealth. So there was time, there was the relationship, there was all those things that were built into it too. So the application is there as long as we're purposeful inside of it. Look, when you have a lot of wealth, financial wealth, you have a lot of opportunities to seize on these things, right? But do you have people that are advising you instead of looking at you and like being apprehensive because you're larger than life? Do you have somebody that really cares about you to give you the advice to say, have you thought about this? Because that's how you could use your wealth in a way that could really be meaningful for you on a go-forward basis. So it was things like that that I endeavored to do throughout my career.
Yeah, no, that's great. Well, the sort of platform from which to have a dialogue. There was trust already established. You saw an opportunity, and I'm sure in the way you did it is you didn't tell someone what to do. You gave them a framework for thinking, right? Because none of us really want to be told what to do. I guess we're yelled at if we're a Navy SEAL. But so as you think about like, okay, so now you're starting to evolve these two and you're starting to take on some of these bigger crucible kind of events. Was there a moment, or was this just you kept on adding like, hey, I could try a little more. I can do a little more. Next year, I want to do something. How are you sort of setting these new objectives? Was the community we're part of, or was it you just wanted to explore deeper and bigger?
I think it was a combination of both of what you just described for me. Certainly, community is important. I mean, I think it was Jim Rohn who said that you are the average of the five people that you're closest with. And yep. And I think that's absolutely true. When I'm around people that I see them doing something, or they encourage me to try this or what have you, that's where I would get exposed to something that I had the choice to make at that point in time. Do I do it or do I not? And so that was it from there. I also was very purposeful around training, frankly. And what I mean by training is that I was purposeful around training areas that I wanted to train in. And one key area was mental toughness. It's always been something that has been very important to me. I love that notion of watching a golfer stand over a 3-foot putt to win the US Open and thinking to myself, this has so much to do with his mental condition at this point in time than the physical nature of the stuff. I mean, they can nail a 3-foot putt, but can they mentally kind of do that? And so training the mind to be able to respond under difficult circumstances. And the reality is that our minds, I'm convinced, they get trained extraordinarily well when they're under stress, right? That's when you really kind of like figure out what you're all about, what your training has done, how do you habitualize kind of like just actions so that you show up and you do very, very well. So when I coupled the community that was very important to me with this endeavor to build mental toughness, I found myself wanting to do these Crucible events. Now, Joe, I'm not one of these people that has to outdo myself the next time. I mean, there are some that have to do something bigger and better the next time. I don't feel that way about me. I don't. I can do the same event and it can be just as difficult or tough because I focus on another area that maybe I didn't focus on before. And so I think this chasing after the next bigger and better thing is there's a little bit of it's interesting to me. I can't make any judgments around that. It's just interesting that that would be the case. For me, I felt like, no, I'm good. Now, I wouldn't take on things that I knew I could just do. I mean, that you don't want to do, but some of these things that I have done, I barely made it through the first time. So going through a second time, I knew it was going to be difficult. That's the reality of the situation.
I like that. Let's talk about this mental toughness a little bit more. How do you define mental toughness?
I would say that for me, it's a steely mind. It's that ability to focus in when all kinds of chaos is going on around you, and having that steely, calm mind in the midst of chaos. That's the thing, knowing how to respond, and that's what I see as mental toughness.
And when you were hanging out with these guys who had been former Navy SEALs and they're training you to be a coach, but also in their programs, what did you see in them that said, yeah, that's a Navy SEAL? Like, how did they show up that was something you were learning from?
I think that the key thing that I noticed, believe it or not, was that they were always thinking about being in service to others. It was amazing to me. They were in service to others. There was an other focusedness that I saw from them that I just loved. Now, it may have been that fact that here they were service providers to me in a sense, but that's not, I mean, you can tell the difference between somebody who's in it for business and somebody who's in it for really that kind of, no, I'm here to help you type of thing. And then on top of that, they were just clearly mentally tough. They knew what they were doing. They were well-trained, extraordinarily well-trained. And frankly, the reason why they were is because they did the work. They showed up, they engaged, they did the work. And so those were the things that I noticed from them.
Yeah, it's great when you have those kind of role models. And it's interesting what you say. I think the SEALs, as I used to read a lot about them, was they trusted each other with their lives is the same point as they're really there to serve each other. I would never let you down because here I am, you're trusting me to protect you. And so then how could I let you down? So my level goes up and up and up, and they keep on doing that for each other, really, almost interestingly, less for themselves. So you become a coach and you do these programs and you start to see people come through the program. A whole bunch of different kinds of people, some who you knew would make it through, some who wouldn't. What were you, as you made that jump from being the person doing it to the person coaching it, what were you starting to feel and see through that process?
Well, I alluded to something that I say to all of the people that I coach, and that is I have one requirement, and it's actually three in one, but it's show up, engage, and do the work. Those are the three things that are there. And what I mean by show up is that you're there, you show up and be there present in what's being requested of you. And engaging is if there's work to be done outside of the coaching relationship, that you are doing that and engaging inside that. And if we're working one-on-one, that you're not looking at your phone or those kind of, there's true FaceTime. It's not just an iPhone app, right? You're engaged from that standpoint. And then do the work is literally, you got to do the work. And so what I have found is that there are some people that just don't do that. And my biggest challenge as a coach is to, it's easy when you have somebody that does all three of those, right? I mean, it's easy. When you don't have those and you're holding somebody accountable and trying to get them to engage or to show up or whatever, that's where the challenging and difficult aspect is. And over time, I've learned that, look, this is their program. It's not mine. It's what they want. And if they don't want to show up or engage and do the work, that's entirely on them. I can't force them to do something. But it is surprising to me at times that somebody would engage a coach and then they don't do those things. So that was fascinating to me.
Yeah, amazing. So then you go through the program, you've been working for a long time. All of a sudden you decide to write a book. I mean, like, hey, there's some piece you got a bridge here for me, right? Like, how does this start to emerge. I think every first-time author sort of is like reluctant author in the beginning. Was that you? How did it bubble up?
Yeah, I mean, look, this was probably a 10-plus year process. Yeah. And it started, frankly, with my own self-awareness and self kind of like reflection and what have you. And really what I wanted to do inside that was to come up with something that helped me to be the best version of myself that I could be without sounding too cliche-ish.
Yeah.
But then when you converge that with my career and what I was doing with working with the folks that I did, there was this very interesting intersection that came to me, an inflection point. And that was that I started to see that there was a much larger story that I like to talk about that we're all caught up in.
Yep.
Okay. I believe that wholeheartedly. And I saw it with my clients because they had financial wealth to tap into larger stories and stuff. But interestingly enough, even though they tapped into a large story, I'm talking about something even bigger than that. I'm talking about like the situation where I'm driving on the 405 freeway in Los Angeles, which if anyone's familiar with it, it's not a freeway. It's a parking lot.
Yep.
And you just inch along. And I sit there and I have this sigh come over me. I think it's a very common sigh that we as human beings have. And the sigh looked like this. Is that it? This is it? Like, that's all there is?
I know, I mean, right.
My story, frankly, felt and feels very large, Joe. Your story feels large. I have a wife. I have a career. I have a daughter. I have a house. I've got a number of different things. And those feel very large, and they are. But then you get stuck on that 405 freeway with that sigh and you say, wow, my life is actually kind of small in the whole grand scheme of things. And so the book is really about how do we tap into that larger story? I happen to believe, Joe, that we tap into it and the result is, quote, true wealth.
Yep, right.
We tap into it when we become fully alive.
Right.
That's when we tap into it. Okay. And so the book talks about a framework that I came up with to help people come fully alive. When I was in college, I graduated. I didn't have two nickels to my name when I graduated. I mean, I had one suit, which was my graduation suit. I bought three shirts, four ties, two pairs of shoes, and I worked at Price Waterhouse wearing the same suit every day because I couldn't afford anything different, right? Before I went and started, I went to Europe and happened to scrape together a money, and I had a backpack, a sleeping bag, and a Eurail pass. And I went to Europe before I started work. It was like the original, I don't even think, they didn't call it gap time at that time. They do now. One of the things I did, Joe, is that I happened to land in Florence, Italy, and I was fortunate to be able to be there. And I'm not an art guy. I'm a jock. But I decided, well, you know what? When in Florence, do what you do in Florence, which is go to a museum. And I did. And in this one museum were works of Michelangelo, and that's why I went there. So I go in, and you go down this hallway, and they are four works that are called the unfinished works of Michelangelo. They are blocks of marble that have just a portion of them having been carved out, an arm or a torso or a head. But let me tell you, they're the perfect arm. They're the perfect torso. It's almost like take yourself and drop yourself into some wet cement halfway, and you got half that's like outside and half that's like buried inside of there. They're actually called the prisoners, it turns out.
Oh, wow.
For great reason, right? Yeah. They are stuck inside this and they need to be released. Well, the way that the curator worked this was that you turn this corner and at the end of this hallway is the statue of the David. And it is the most spectacular piece of art I've ever seen. It's 14 feet tall.
I know.
It is absolutely glorious. It's white. It's beautiful. And your breath is taken away. Well, years later, as I either sat on the 405 freeway or I was just contemplating life in general, I thought to myself, that is the analogy of our life.
Right.
We all have this raw material that we're made out of. And somebody comes along, whether they be parents or teachers or coaches, and they help chip away so that when we're stuck inside there, we start to come alive a little bit. And then when we are fully released and we are kind of living in glory, if you will, and I mean that in a good sense, right? Not in an arrogant way, but in that place where you just know you're made to do this, then you are that David, and people are attracted to you as a result of it. Mm-hmm. The book is all about trying to figure out, how do we come fully alive? Yeah. How do we become that David, that thing that's attractive to others, so that not only can we develop true wealth for ourselves, but that wealth actually gets spread to others as a result of that. That's what the Delta Theorem is all about. And that's why I wrote the book in a 10-year process of going through this.
That's beautiful. I sort of look at art and I can appreciate it as an amateur. And I was in Florence and I saw David, and I actually don't really know why we're all so struck by it, because in one way it's just too simple and it's overwhelming though. It's almost as if we're feeling Michelangelo in it, like it's spiritual, even if you're not spiritual feeling. So I totally, when you were saying that, it just brought me back to there. And yeah, that the a friend who's a sculptor, and he always says, we're not carving anything, we're taking away, we're liberating what's already in there. And so your book and your work is liberating what's already inside someone. We just haven't figured out yet how to get it out. And when we do, the Statue of David is there and available for others to sort of appreciate that we should go through that process similarly. So I think the writing process is great for the writer, right? Because it sort of forces you to crystallize all of that, this 10 years, this 30 years, this like, well, maybe I write another book, but maybe I don't, but it doesn't really matter because I'm working on this. And so then you finish it and you publish it. Now people are reading it. How are you feeling about sort of this part of the process now that it's out there in the wild? You can go on Amazon. There's some just beautiful reviews on Amazon. It's available for sale. I read it. It's got great stories and frameworks and real good structure. So it's not just like a only coffee table book or like fiction. So how do you feel about it? It's like, did it end up how you wanted? Is it having the impact that you were hoping? Is it just sort of like, where is it?
Yeah. So let me talk a little bit about the early process. And I think you probably can appreciate this. It was scary to put it, not because I thought it would flop, but because it was me.
Yeah.
And right. That is a very scary thing to put yourself out there. Right. And so that was the original thing that was very scary inside of it. Joe, I pretty much had this idea that when I put it out there, I was just going to trust the process. And it was like, whatever happens with it, happens with it.
Yeah.
Many people ask me, how are the sales and all that? Look, I get it. And it's done well. And it's received accolades on Amazon and what have you, and rankings and that kind of stuff. But the reality is that if it literally impacts one person's life, then I'm stoked on that. I mean, yep. I really am. So when you receive a review and it's one that really kind of speaks about how their life was impacted as a result of it, that's extraordinarily rewarding. And so it has done what I had hoped that it would do. And I think more than anything else, probably, is that I did it.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, yeah. I did it. I got it done. Here's the funny thing. There's this tactic that we all hear about, and that is, write your goal down, put it on a piece of paper, stick it in front of you, and then look at it all the time. And then that's what will help you to like kind of get there and that kind of stuff. I actually did that. And here's what it was. About 6 years ago, or 6 years prior to publishing the book, I wrote, I will write a book by the age of 60. That's what I did. And I put it up somewhere and it was there. I delivered the book to the publisher on February 28th, 2023. My birthday, my 60th birthday, was March 10th, 23. That was to me like, okay, this is good. Okay. I did it. I said I was going to do this. I followed through. How many people don't follow through on their ideas and their dreams? It's just, no, I'm not going to be one of those people. I'm going to fall through. And the result of it was well received. And so I think that's the cherry on top of it for me.
I'm going to try something with you. So There are these words that always sound really big and they're intimidating. And so one of them is this idea of transcendence. And so we're like, oh my God, what could that possibly mean? And so we go on our journey and we can study Buddhist religion. We can find other methods and retreats and all of that. And then you find, at least this is what I found, and let's see what you found, is that transcendence is the day when you sort of finally love yourself and become comfortable with who we are. We're no longer proving, really it is never to the world. It's only to ourselves, the proof, right? The rest is a reflection that we're hoping tells us how we should feel. It's your wealthy clients that you had who are still not feeling good about themselves. It's the people on stage who we clap for who have imposter syndrome. They haven't found this thing. And so in that intention that you set and your delivery against that intention, you have this transcendent experience because what you did was you did it, right? This was Brett overcoming himself to finally say, hey, I actually think enough of myself to write this book. I don't know if this makes any sense to you, but I've been thinking about it a lot lately.
Yeah, for sure. I think that when I think of transcendence in the whole process of the book, yes, getting it out there, it felt very good in the way that you're describing. My acknowledgement section, probably the transcendence.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because it was there that I was able to thank and acknowledge all the people that helped me get to this place.
Right, right.
And that felt transcendent when those people got to pick it up and read their name in there and know what they meant. Or it feels transcendent to know that people that are picking up the book and reading it, and their name isn't in there, but they're reading about some of these people.
Yeah.
That gives me great joy and transcendence to have written that section and published that section for all the world to be able to see. That was very special.
Yeah, big ripple effect that comes from that because, well, so it's interesting because I would just say, yeah, I totally understand and agree with everything you said. You had to show up for yourself to be able to recognize them and understand that. Like I have been married for quite a bit of time myself. And I, instead of anniversary cards, always wrote to Anthea a thank you note instead to say thank you for supporting me and who I am. Like not trying to change me into something else you wanted me to be, but celebrating the person that you decided to go on this journey with. And I think that's what is often missing, right? Is that what we're here to do is to both support each other. And that's what happened for you. And that's why you thanked everyone because they wanted Brett to be Brett.
That's right. That's right.
Showed up.
That's right.
Beautiful.
Yeah. That's exactly correct. Yeah. I love that, Joe. I mean, I love that notion that we're writing a thank you note. That's really terrific.
Yeah. To try to even almost kick ourselves sometimes a little bit into where we should be. That's what I think the books are good for. I don't think a book is something that like we have to, 1 year, I read 52 business books, one a week. And about 2/3 of the way in there, I was like, well, there's no notes to be taken.
Right.
This is about just affecting my thinking, right? And there would, because you thought in the beginning, oh, that's a great idea. Here's another great idea. But they're only to just sort of trigger what we should become and can become through what we ask of ourselves. And that's what's so great about that book process, because well, it forced you to actually make all sense out of all these great things you learned, share it with others, but also then connect the two together.
Yeah, yeah. Some of the best parts that I love having written are the most vulnerable and the scariest components of stuff. And there's a lot of stuff that was left on the editing floor. And those were not the ones that were left on the editing floor. And they were also the hardest to keep in there because I'm putting my heart out there and letting people see that there's some parts of me that I aren't so pretty, right? But that's the essence of being human, right? Not the ability to do that, but that we can connect with each other. My intention was kind of that Navy SEAL intention in service to others.
Yeah.
There's somebody else out there that has that same story and they're thinking to themselves, oh, this author, he would, no, that's my story.
Yeah.
And we're in this together. And there is a way that I've been able to work through some of these things. And so there's probably a way for you to be able to work through these things too. So yeah that was all part of the process too.
I think that thing we could possibly say is, why does it take us so long? But patience is part of that process. Being when we're 25 and we're like full of vim and vigor and we're firing like on all cylinders, but we want to be somewhere immediately. And then like I often say, like, well, if you had another 75 years to go, how would you want to use them? Like it is a while. So I do think that coming to grips with that over time, this idea that maybe the first third of our life is about sort of establishing our footprint. The second is about family and work. And the third is about giving back and community and serving the rest of the world. It seems like you've found yourself to the third. We won't have to put a time frame on it, but that feeling, huh?
Yes, for sure. You nailed it. When I retired from the wealth management space, one of the things that I was telling some of my colleagues, and frankly, they were surprised. I mean, they just, what? You're retiring? He said, listen, here's the deal. I see my life as a hockey match. There's three periods here, just like you said, Joe. The first period, I call it study, right? I mean, that's what we're doing. We're studying and we're learning. Second period is success. And that's what we're trying to do with family, with our careers and that kind of stuff. And the third area I call significance. And that is the ability to give back. And I thought I'm still young enough to where I have the ability to try to like give back. I don't have money that was my client's money.
Right.
I made a good living and obviously I'm able to do those things and I thank God for that. But still, I could have made more. That wasn't what it was all about. It was about now, how do I take these lessons and do I share them with others? I wrote the book to my daughter, frankly. Mm. And that was the intent, was to have her kind of like learn about these things. And it just so happens that in the course of that, I think that there's a lot of daughters and sons and people out there that can also benefit as well.
Yeah. Let's talk for a minute about this with purpose on purpose. That's one of your core.
Yeah, look, I believe that all of us really need to be intentional. And intentional is the with purpose on purpose, that we're thoughtful, that we don't just go through life haphazardly. It's already volatile and uncertain and chaotic and ambiguous. You know, what the Navy SEALs and others call VUCA, that's the world that we're in. So how can we navigate through this? And I believe that it requires us to be very intentional. Taking your son into a conference room with you when you are the chairman of the board is very intentional. Using your finances to be able to help others in need or what, that's very intentional. Writing a book so that your daughter can grow up and learn from some of these things, that's intentional. So with purpose, on purpose is what that is all about. Now, the word purpose is very critical to me because I do believe that people need to really do the work to focus in on what they believe their powerful why is. Because when they have that is when they're able to, one, make decisions better because they can know what's inside their purpose and what's outside their purpose. And so they can make a decision accordingly. And number two, it will give them resilience when the proverbial stuff hits the fan.
Yep.
Because you know what your powerful why and what your purpose is all about. Then when stuff is coming against you, and it always does, you're able to dig down because, oh no, tap back into what my powerful why is. My powerful why at that point in time of getting my coaching certification was to not get voted off the island and to get that certification.
Yeah.
And so I got up at 4 a.m. and I endured cold mornings and cold water and all kinds of chaos and VUCA and everything else because that's was what my why was all about. And frankly, it built resilience, mental toughness, all the things that I wanted. And I was intentional about those things to make it happen.
Yeah. The other word that sort of strikes me that relates to this is this word of authenticity that we hear often, like, oh, they're authentic. And like, oh, what does that really mean? And I think that authenticity is when your purpose is how you show up because you have purpose. And so it's very consistent. And then when you talk to someone or you're on stage, it's like, oh yeah, that just makes sense. Rather than someone reading a script or a teleprompter, this is what we would want to hear. And why my favorite is like this idea of the difference between telling stories and being a storyteller.
Yeah.
You know, the storyteller has to have purpose because they need to bring you along. And to bring you along, you have to have purpose because otherwise you wouldn't have that emotional feeling.
That's right. That's right. Look, my purpose these days is to inspire people to come alive. Yeah. That shouldn't come as a surprise inside of this. That's my purpose. And not everything that I do is always like geared towards that purpose. But often enough, I will tap back into that and go, yeah, I want to inspire people to come alive. And that could mean me making a fool of myself. And sometimes I do. And the reason is because I know that there's somebody who's looking and it gives them the freedom to be themselves.
Yeah.
And that means that I could potentially inspire them to come alive. It's not a shtick. It's not a game. It's what I love to do. That's who I want to be. That's who I am. And so that's what this is all about. That wasn't always the case. I mean, when I was earlier in my life, my purpose was to raise a family that I was able to show character in my marriage and with my kids, right? Or my daughter. And so purpose does change over time. It does, because life changes. Our eras change and that kind of stuff. So I think that that's really critical. One of the things that I found, Joe, and you probably experienced this too, is that if I ask people when I'm coaching them, tell me what your purpose is, they look at me with deer in headlights, often cases. They're like, I have no idea. And frankly, if I tell you what it is, does that mean it can never change?
Right.
And that scares me to be able to say that. So I'd prefer not to say anything, right? So that is a really critical thing. But boy, if you don't do the work, which my book walks through a framework of helping somebody find their purpose, and it doesn't start with asking the question, what's your purpose? It starts with other areas that help you to determine what it is you believe your purpose to be. That's really, really critical.
Yeah, I think those are the questions that we're learning matter. Like, who am I? What do I want my legacy to be? What's my purpose? These are intentional statements. They're things that we need to work towards. We need to show up in our own minds about them or have a process to get to an answer. We don't have the answer because we were never even asked the questions. So like, how would that actually happen, right? So the framework is really important, especially because it took you a long time without a framework to figure that out.
It did. And I want my daughter to have a hack to be able to help her along those lines so that it doesn't take her 60 years to get there.
I like that. And the question I won't ask you is there a second book? Because that's sort of a throwaway question. But now that it's out and you're feeling good about it, like, how are you? You got some more time back in your day because you're not working manuscripts and everything else. What's your sort of like, I'll go to my chasing tomorrow. What are you going to sort of point yourself towards over the next couple of years here?
What you and I are doing right now.
Perfect.
Engaging with people from that perspective. It could be a podcast. It could be one-on-one coffees with people. It can be, you know, God willing, maybe some speaking engagements to larger groups of people. That's kind of the things that are there. But it truly is about not selling books. It's about inspiring people to come alive. I heard this quote. Maybe you've heard it. It was by a gentleman by the name of Howard Thurman. And he said this, don't ask what the world needs. Let me start again. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and do that. Because what the world needs is more people who are fully alive. Just think about that, man.
Yeah.
Don't ask what the world needs. That's like a sales marketing thing. Ask what makes you come alive and do that. Because what the world needs, and I'd say the world is attracted to, is more people who are fully alive. Love it. It fits in obviously with what I'm all about. It's also potentially dangerous if not done with maturity. Playing golf for a living could be making me feel alive, right? That's what I love to do or whatever. And yet I have a wife, I have a daughter, I've got some responsibilities and that kind of stuff. So it's not to be used irresponsibly. It's to be cultivated. Passion is cultivated. It's not just followed blindly. You develop it over time. And that's what that quote is all about. And so, Joe, that's what the next is for me, is to do exactly what we're doing right now.
Well, Brett, this has been just fabulous. I'm so excited for you and the book. Everyone should look for The Delta Theorem on Amazon or anywhere else you could buy it. Read it, write a great review. I'm sure if you message Brett, because his info is on the Amazon page, he would love to talk to you. And Brett, we will talk again and check in. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a great, great fun for me.